The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you know, this is the wrap-up for the year. It is also the week between Christmas and New Year's, so we can't be too depressed here or make it too dark. You know, we were talking about what would we characterize this year? I mean, sort of a bird's-eye view, and you said substructural. Now, I've got to admit, oftentimes, David, when you give me a one-word answer, I really need more elaboration. So what do you mean by substructural?
The primary changes that we've seen in 2011 are all substructural changes. They have to do with the undercurrents in the money system and a slow erosion of confidence in fiat.
Right.
When we're seeing that, not just in the U.S., but globally, that's just one example of a substructural change.
Would you say political?
Oh, absolutely.
It's the same type of thing?
And it doesn't matter if you're in North Africa, if you're in Asia, if you're in
Russia,
Europe, the U.S. There are these substructural changes where lines are being defined very differently than they were, say, 2 or 4 years ago.
Right.
The U.S. is a perfect case in point where on the one end of the political spectrum, you've got the Occupy Wall Street. On the other end, you've got the Tea Party. And you're really looking at defined modalities of the far left and far right saying, we're not happy with the status quo. We don't think the Democrats are doing a good job. Or on the other hand, we don't think the Republicans are doing a good job. And there are these now greater clarifications being made in terms of what the priorities are, what the expectations are coming into 2012, which really makes 2012 a difficult year to look at. We'll do that in future weeks here, Kevin, as we anticipate, as we try to look ahead to what 2012 may hold. But today, what we're going to focus on is the major things that have happened in 2011 and the guests that we've had that highlighted those things.
You know, David, I think of what's occurred this year, you know, the what we call the Arab Spring and this movement right now of supposedly the people. And then, of course, we had Occupy Wall Street, which these guys think it was an organic movement. Of course, there was some organization, but there's a lot of people out there sensing right now a lack of leadership. And, you know, when we talked about doing this program, we thought, well, why don't we just go back and look at some of the things some of the guests have said going back to the first of the year. And one of the things we were sensing at the beginning of the year was this headlessness of the world. There doesn't seem to be any leadership. There doesn't seem to be any direction or long-term strategic thinking governmentally, you know. And so I think of our guest going back to the beginning of the year, George Friedman of Stratfor. He talked about how America is an empire, whether they like it or not. But one of the things that we lack right now is the leadership that's required if you are empire. In other words, we don't have a Ronald Reagan right now. We don't have an Abraham Lincoln or a George Washington. So do we see right now occurring worldwide and here in America this outcry for some sort of direction?
Well, and the question is, what does that look like in a post-2012 world? As we've noted a number of times, half of the G20 leadership changes next year, and it's in the process of organizing itself for campaign bids and everything else. So what the leadership looks like in 2013 and beyond is going to be very different. The decisions taken in that period of time may be very different than the previous administration. So, and this is kind of a preview of our conversation today, when we had the conversation with Franck Biancheri, the gentleman from France.
Right.
The issue there is that he sees the world after the crisis very different than the world before the crisis.
He sees creative destruction. He sees creativity and more unity coming into Europe, not a destruction of Europe.
And it's not predicated on present leadership somehow having an about face or an epiphany of what should be done, but we're talking about a completely different kind of leadership to begin with.
Well, David, I think it's important to understand. We talk about Europe. We talk about China. You and your dad talk about China. We talk about these different regions in the world. But even with the problems America has, you brought up the point to me just recently that even if America's GDP got cut by half, we're still larger than China by 2 times. And, you know, the European Union isn't really truly a union. You still have to look at these nations individually to a degree as far as strength. So the United States, even if cut in half, is still empire, is it not?
It is. And that gets to Friedman's point, which is before you write off the West and start writing it in a new script with the East and sort of the rise of Asia in mind, you have to be careful. There's a lot of ground that they have to cover on the upside and a lot of ground that we have to cover on the downside to get us to parity. Following a drop in the euro in 2012, which is something that's very probable, you know, will the dollar regain some measure of strength, even if it's only on a relative basis?
Right.
You know, and again, that has to do with who's in a worse situation. I don't think we're past the European issues. We've spent a lot of time on them, certainly in the commentary this year, 2011, but we have not seen any real resolution. So the issues remain. We still have the debts that have to be paid. We still have the inability of a lot of your sovereign states to raise enough capital. And thus we see the same thing overseas as we've had here in the United States, direct monetization by the central banking authorities. If there's excess or overhang of debt to be offered, rather than that impair the debt markets and cause an increase in interest rates,
right,
those central bankers are just coming in as a cleanup operation and taking the scraps off the table and saying, hey, yet another successful bond option.
Well, David, we saw that. Remember, we did the program about 3 weeks ago called the 13 Days of Christmas,
right,
and we were talking about how much debt actually comes due in Europe. Well, one of the things about the Europeans is they don't like missing their vacations and they don't like missing holidays. So, you know, people might ask, well, gosh, whatever happened to the 13 Days of Christmas, the demise of Europe? Well, they did exactly what you're saying. They printed money, they went into more debt, they guaranteed low interest loans to the banks, and they all jumped in. David, I think it was a trade like in 2008 where all of a sudden just the garbage collateral, if you can call it that, got thrown onto the central bank, and the loans, the nice liquidity, so to speak, goes back into the hands of the banks.
Well, Kevin, you and I discussed this several weeks ago, the idea that somehow creating an unlimited, using those words, which they now have used,
right,
an unlimited backstop for the banks in terms of a lending facility,
right,
would somehow be healthy for the banks. All that allowed for, Kevin, was for speculators to come in and dump the products which they had hesitantly held in their portfolios, unable to sell because they couldn't get a good enough price. And now they've got the central bank guaranteeing a stable price and a stable market for the product that they've been trying to ditch. And that's exactly what they did.
So how do you say moral hazard in German or French or Belgian? I mean, how do you say moral hazard? Because that's exactly what we have when you guarantee any loan.
Right. Well, I think what we're going to get to experience in the U.S. is some degree of, and this isn't the definition of moral hazard, but Schadenfreude is certainly something that we'll be able to smile and say, ah, well, it is pretty bad still in Europe, although we have our issues pending.
Well, David, it's interesting. As we went into February, we had a return guest on, and I always love it when Mark Faber is on because he just doesn't mince words. You know, Mark said the Germans weren't happy with the bailout of the pigs. We've seen that this year. But he said something, what we're seeing now, where they're just papering over these debts in Europe. He said, guys, get it here. The budget never, ever will be balanced, period. Just get used to that.
Well, and that supports that thesis that it's either going one direction or the other. Default as one alternative, where you run up the debts to the point where you just have to walk away, or you pay off the debts with cheaper and cheaper currency via the printing presses. So you print your way out of it rather than have an outright default. And Faber's point is in Europe, they're now in the same place that we are in the U.S. We actually are in the same boat. This is a real challenge. It's an either or. And what we would suggest is that we probably have an advantage over them and that we still maintain the world's reserve currency.
Right.
We have an extra layer of abuse that we can bring to the marketplace. And I say abuse because it is an abuse of the privilege. It is an abuse of the trust. It is an abuse of the position that we're in, a position of power in the world's monetary system. The dollar is still the king of the world's monetary system.
Well, and even though the dollar is still king of the monetary system, you brought out a great point earlier that the dollar isn't gaining in value. Even though relative to the euro it is, the buying power of the dollar dropped. You know, Mark Faber, when he was talking to us back in February, gold was just a little above $1,300 an ounce. And Mark Faber said, look, guys, even if commodities drop this year, gold should rise. And sure enough, even though gold's had a volatile year, it's finishing up very nicely.
Well, and what was interesting about his comment in February, that was February 23rd, is that the first quarter actually saw a huge increase in commodity prices, and gold wasn't doing much. So this was a counterintuitive comment at the time.
That's like Mark, though.
Right, because yeah, you actually had the idea of a return to growth in the economy supported by your industrial commodities and ags going crazy.
Right.
It was as we headed into the second and third quarter that we went from sort of robust growth to a massive contraction. And, you know, our trip to London, we'd met met some folks and they said, listen, as far as our businesses in Africa are concerned, we're seeing a cutback of up to 2/3 of business orders. We're talking about nickel, we're talking about copper, we're talking about molybdenum, you know, the basic stuff that goes into other stuff. So at sort of the front edge of the economy is slowing, not speeding up. We had an indication of the first quarter that ended up being completely thrown out just a few months later, and that's what Faber was implying. You're going to see a decline in these commodities. Meanwhile, I think gold will do quite well as it differentiates itself, not as another one of the mix.
But it's a currency.
Specifically a commodity, but actually different being a currency.
And that's what Mark Faber has always pointed out. You know, Richard Russell's pointed this out. A number of people who've seen this thing and analyzed this thing for decades don't look at gold as a commodity. They look at it as a currency. But, you know, what's interesting too, Dave, is this. And this, I'm going back to the dollar, because I heard this analogy the other day and I thought it was brilliant. People moving out of the euro and into the dollar, which is what we've seen over the last month especially, and seen the dollar rally against the euro. The analogy is like jumping off of the Hindenburg, which took less than a minute to crash to ground, and onto the Titanic, which took just a little over 2 hours to sink. You still have declining outcome. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's still a death outcome. Now, what happens? Here's my question. What happens when capital has to fly out of the dollar and go somewhere else? I mean, the dollar's right now got a false buoy with the European situation, but the dollar has a deficit problem itself.
It does. Before we get there, Kevin, there's one other point to make, because there's this whole issue of 2011 really being a judgment of the concerns in Europe and the U.S. being concerns relating to liquidity.
Mm.
So why did the dollar see lots of traffic? For the same reason that the yen saw lots of traffic. The whole world says, where can I park money and not disrupt the market? I need to be able to come in with a couple $1 billion or a couple $100 billion and leave as well without making huge ripples.
Right.
And the yen and the dollar are really the only places that have that depth outside of the euro. So those are the three that have this immense liquid pool, if you will, where you can come and go as you please. Again, coming back to substructural changes,
right,
what a lot of people have recognized in 2011, it's been kind of a divide between those who have continued to judge this as a liquidity crisis and thus go to dollars and yen, and others who've said, yeah, liquidity crisis today is solvency crisis tomorrow, and I'm not going to wait around, whether it is the Hindenburg, as you say, Kevin,
right,
or the Titanic. Either instance, we're concerned about solvency, not
right,
liquidity. So I would judge 2012, maybe it stretches to 2013, as the wake-up call for the general public that this is, in fact, a solvency issue, and now all of a sudden the judgment on the basis of liquidity to be in yen or in dollars, that was a mistake and has to be reversed.
It reminds me of the game Hot Potato. If you've ever played Hot Potato, where they heat the potato up to boiling temperature and then you play the game and whoever holds it the longest gets burned. Liquidity is a little bit like that, isn't it? I mean, the security issue is a longer term issue, but frankly, I would have jumped out of the Hindenburg myself onto the deck of the Titanic, knowing that it was still going to sink.
You still got time.
Because it was hot in the Hindenburg.
Yeah, and you've still got time.
Okay.
I think that's an accurate statement, Kevin, that I think it's 2013 that a broader awareness of solvency issues are obvious, because frankly, 2012 is sort of a blackout year. It's a distractible year where people are more concerned about politics. Politicians are trying to claim success on the basis of 2011 numbers. They're trying to look forward to 2013 and they're courting constituency groups. There's really not going to be anything that happens of a productive nature in the economy because it's all about politics. So to where the rubber really meets the road, I think we really are looking at a year of white noise where we actually see traction or lack thereof come 2013.
Okay, but there will come a time when people say, all right, I've been holding these dollars. It is a hot potato. It's time now to move to security.
This
takes us to March.
Yeah, because we talked to Richard Rahn.
Right.
You know, Richard is an interesting guy. We talked to him about FATCA. That's the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, and that comes into effect in 2013. It's something that could have a major impact on the U.S. equity markets as we see foreign holders of securities, U.S.-based securities, whether that's bonds or stocks, now brought into our compliance framework and essentially being proxy IRS agents. So you've got the world's global financial system saying no to the U.S. financial system because the IRS and Treasury Department are overstretching their boundaries.
Well, David, we've really seen that this year. How many bank accounts that were Swiss bank accounts, Americans, that were completely legal, have been shut down by the Swiss because they just don't want to play anymore?
They don't. They don't have anything to do with the U.S. because we represent a huge liability. Anything
right,
that puts them in the daily operations, if you will, of the Treasury, the IRS, Hamas, they want nothing to do with. You also have the new FBAR rules, Kevin, and what's apparent is that the Treasury and the IRS are getting very, very aggressive, making laws so complex that essentially everyone is a lawbreaker. And it's just a question of whether or not they can put you in under the microscope to be proven such. Kevin, I think what we're really seeing when you look at the Treasury and IRS getting as aggressive as they are is that they're anticipating capital flight.
Right.
Whether it is 2012 or 2013.
It's when they're jumping off the Titanic.
Exactly.
There they go.
When you see the dollar become anathema, the Treasury and the IRS have already set up the structure to where you cannot take U.S.-based capital and redomicile it. You can't take it into a foreign currency. You can't take it into a foreign bank. You can't take it into a foreign institution. You are on deck, and there is not enough room in the lifeboats. They have already sailed.
Well, and, you know, with these rules coming up, I think you're saying there's an anticipation for this time to come. Barry Eichengreen, our guest in April, wrote a book called Exorbitant Privilege. And what he was talking about was the history of how we've gone to the dollar, just purely the dollar, as the world's reserve currency. And, of course, you have to go back pretty much almost 100 years to watch that cycle play itself out. But Eichengreen is saying that 2013, he felt, was a potential day of reckoning for the dollar, where this capital flight might actually start moving out.
Well, and what we're seeing is a growing competition amongst central bankers who have to figure out how to finance these independent treasuries. So for us, it's the Treasury and the Fed trying to figure out how to recycle debt, how to renew or roll over the debt. So you've got the debt that's coming due plus new financing needs.
You know, whether a person agrees with Eichengreen's ultimate outcome, which he believes is ultimately the dollar having to be, you know, moved into another basket of currencies to make a reserve currency, that may or may not happen. But one of the things that we do know is there are trillions and trillions of dollars that are coming due. Not new debt, but this is stuff like you were talking about, rollover debt. You still have to have a buyer for that as well.
Kevin, there was an interesting point that Barry did not mean to make, but he did. I mean, he's an economist. He's at University of California, Berkeley. And he was not intending to give social commentary, but he did. Will the dollar, as the world's singular reserve currency, last? Do we have this monopoly that continues heretofore? And he's saying no, it's not going to. But the way he's packaging it, the way he sold it in Exorbitant Privilege, is by saying it's not stable, it's not safe.
Right.
To have one currency as the hub, it's not safe. And that in itself, if you think about our social structure today, we've been conditioned over a period of 30 to 40 years to consider bike riding a hazard to our children's health if they don't have a helmet on.
Right.
You grew up without a helmet, and actually, I think it turned out pretty well in spite of a few spills. But, you know, and we all did. We all did.
We don't even imagine
it. Couldn't even imagine it,
right,
because we're that much more safety conscious and risk aware. But it's not real risk aware. It's these strange little quirky things that we're very afraid of. And I think it's been framed such that on the next major catastrophe, you've got the moneyed elite in America, which get to say, see, this is the problem.
Right.
This is the problem, and here's the solution. And we could have told you this, and we tried to tell you this. In fact, we did. Here's the literature in which we explained that this was not safe. And now we will effectively regulate this towards safety, where you don't have to worry anymore. You don't have to worry about loss or ultimate demise.
Here's your helmet, basically, is what they're saying. Okay, now, David, isn't this really just a repeating cycle? I'm thinking of our May guest, Neil Howe. And, you know, he talks about all through history, you have seasons in 80 to 100-year cycles that continue to repeat. You have the spring season, and then the summer season, the fall, and then the winter, which he calls the fourth turning, and then you go into the next spring season. You know, I'm thinking of Eichengreen now before we move to Neil Howe, but going back to 1913 to 22. And
I mean, the last 100 years, I mean, it's not an exact overlay, but it is interesting in terms of the development of our currency system. That period, 1913 to 1922, when the Federal Reserve was created and before the Conference of Genoa, where we still had more or less a gold standard, and we still had to have gold as the primary backing, the primary reserve asset at all your world central banks. That changed in 22, and then from 22 to 44, before we launched into the Bretton Woods era,
right,
we left the gold standard, went to a quasi-gold standard.
And the other countries did too. Britain left the gold standard, France left the gold standard, so you were seeing each one drop off the discipline bandwagon.
And then we went 44 to 71, the Bretton Woods era, and the Bretton Woods era was defined by that post-war peace, and we negotiated it very handsomely for ourselves,
right,
that all the world's currencies would relate to the U.S. dollar.
Why? Because it was backed by gold.
And so basically, we guaranteed all the world's central banks if we owe you money, you can have it either in dollars or gold. It's the same thing.
And then Nixon
just done that.
Temporarily reneged on that. Now, it's temporary still. but in 1971, he closed the gold window, Dave.
And we launched into this fourth period of time, which sort of defines the present monetary instability.
Yeah.
And that is a period in time where paper has nothing backing it. And yet everyone still has confidence to some degree or another that it is what we use to transact business. Whether it's credit or debit, at the end of the day, we're really talking about dollars and greenbacks, and behind that stands nothing. In stark contrast to all of world and monetary history, in which people, having learned the lesson the hard way, could not have confidence in their central banker and actually wanted something backing,
right,
dollar for dollar, their representation of wealth.
So do you think the understanding of real money is coming back? You know, Neil Howe talks about, one of the things I'm going to just point out, Dave, is you enjoyed the book The Fourth Turning, not to talk about fourth turnings or the third or the second. You were interested in the next first turning because you said, all right, after all this mess occurs
every
80 to 100 years.
Just so we're not getting too close to the book without someone being familiar with it, that fourth turning is a period of social decay. It's basically, these are all short cycles. You can have, say, for instance, in the Roman Empire, they could have had three or four of these periods of expansion and decline,
right,
within their total empire in terms of the stretch, that 400-year stretch that they were around. In Great Britain, we saw at least two of these periods of expansion and ultimate decline, social decay. But following that period of social, political, and moral decline came a period of renewal and rebirth. And again, it was along economic lines, it was along political lines, it was along even social and spiritual lines.
So rather than just be doom and gloom about the period we're in, it's basically looking forward and saying, all right, what can we set up now? What can we start thinking about now after this thing completely destroys itself so that we can see a system that actually brings about maybe equal weights and measures?
Well, that's very true, Kevin. I think that awareness and that expectancy, it ties to what we've encouraged our clients to consider is what is their responsibility, not just in terms of surviving very difficult financial and economic times, but thriving now and into the future. If you lack the imagination to see the future, you're locked in a strange, strange trap. It's a deadly trap and one that we would encourage you to try to extricate yourself from as quickly as possible. See the future for what it is. As much challenge as we have in our immediate present, the future holds something very different.
Well, you know, that takes us to our next guest. And we just had Bill King on just last week. We love to have Bill King on at least twice, maybe three times a year, because he's got an overview mentality longer term, but he also trades on the short term. And Bill King was saying, look, we are currently seeing the collapse of Western socialism right now in front of us, over in Europe, and actually to a degree here in the United States.
And then what we mean by that is just that you can't continue to borrow from Peter to pay Paul,
right,
and expand sort of your largesse in terms of government spending without increasing revenues. And actually what we have had in the last 3 or 4 years is the final wake-up call. You know, as long as there is exponential growth, and we talked about this with Chris Martinson, exponential growth in the economy supports exponential growth in debt. But if the economy slows and you don't have exponential growth, but you continue to spend beyond your means,
you don't have a slowdown, you have a collapse.
That's what precipitates a financial collapse. And that's what King's talking about, this idea of Western socialism. You can't continue to spend more and more governmentally without that in lockstep growth in the economy. And now we don't have the growth in the economy to support it, and yet we're not tightening our belts.
Well, and being a professional trader, you know, we've asked him each time, okay, Bill, what do we do right now with our money if we're seeing this collapse? You know, he keeps going back to something that sounds fairly boring, but he talks about cash and gold. In other words, keep your powder dry. Make sure you live through this financially so that you can capitalize on that next opportunity, that first turning, whatever we want to call it.
It's a defensive posture. It's a defensive posture, one that insures you against the stupidity of governments making bad decisions under pressure. And frankly, from a lot of change that can't be anticipated. So how do you preserve value during these periods of compression? His opinion would match ours in that regard, keeping it a very defensive posture.
Well, you know, and that takes us to our July guest, Felix Zuloff. Zuloff was, that was a great interview. For our listeners who want to go back and listen to a interview from this last year, it was one of my favorites. That was July 6th. And one of the things that he brought out was this. we are looking at, in the next 3 to 5 years, an inflationary depression. Now, what we've had up to this point, we can point out that there has been some inflation, monetary inflation. Prices have risen. We haven't had a hyperinflation. It has not occurred on a worldwide basis, really, in many years. And, you know, what he's talking about, however, is a sudden event at some point where we will have high hyperinflation.
Well, and it goes back to sort of Haverstein's dream, the idea that if you don't have the money, you just print it. And this is what happened in 1919 and 1924.
Now, is that helicopter Ben Bernanke as well?
I think they're actually related. Haverstein and Bernanke, if you go back, there's actually a tie. But he was head of the central bank in Germany, 1919 and 1924. And in all of his economic cohorts and colleagues thought he was a genius. We don't have enough money in the system?
Right.
Not a problem. We'll just print more money.
Could we call him maybe the maestro?
Well, that's a lot of what we have today is if we don't have the money, we just print it. The ECB has fallen prey to that. If you wanted to look at sort of the soldier that we were counting on to not go this route, they fell prey to the temptation in 2011. The ECB has monetized and printed beyond the scope that they're comfortable with, but they still did it. And so we've sort of passed beyond the boundary line that they set for themselves. And really, there's no central bank in the world today who is not willing to and actively printing to solve their economic problems. So whether we know it or not, we're at the front edge. Call it a 1919, if you will, where inflation was only 6% in Germany at the beginning of the year. By the end of 1919, it was pressing 200%. As we went into 1920, 1921, it was now moving from triple to quadruple digits. And then, of course, it went into triple and quadruple digits on a monthly basis, which made their annual inflation rates just off the charts.
Well, and David, to put that in perspective, because most of us, we don't think in percentages. We think in the price of maybe bread or gasoline. But what we're talking about here is a loaf of bread going from $3 or $4 to 30 or 40 very quickly to 300 or 400 to tens of thousands of dollars. Well, I'm talking a loaf of bread. Now, people can look at their assets right now and they can say, well, I've saved for my retirement. I've got X amount. You go through a hyperinflation and you can just pretty much kiss all that goodbye.
Inflation sets an economy back by at least a generation.
Unless you're in gold.
Well, and that's what I'm saying is that for individuals, it's different. A nation, in terms of the social and political dynamics, it's very unhealthy. In fact, the hyperinflation in Germany led to sort of the ultra-nationalistic rise of the National Socialist Party and ultimately of Hitler. And it gave the Germans the ability to reclaim some dignity.
Right.
That's a very dangerous road to go down. It's a very dangerous road to go down. But it was filling the void of humiliation following the Treaty of Versailles and the payments which had to be made. And so you basically had pride stripped of the people and pride returned. And it was tragic that it happened in the way that it did. But, you know, again, back to Felix Zuloff's comments, the fact that the next 3 to 5 years represents a ramping up of an inflationary depression on a global basis. Zuloff is an asset manager in Zug, Switzerland. It's beautiful, sitting right on the lake. And, you know, if there was an inflationary depression, I can think of very few places I'd rather be. There's a lot of gold in Switzerland, and it's a beautiful place at the same time. But one of the points that he made, Kevin, was, again, something we've mentioned earlier today and many times this year, which is gold is a currency, not a commodity. And this is something that is, again, a substructural change. It's a change in perception. People did not appreciate it as such. We spent 25 to 30 years considering it the same as orange juice contracts, pork bellies, and things that, you know, you generally have no interest in other than consuming for one purpose or another, maybe breakfast on a Saturday morning. Why do you need gold? It's just another commodity, and frankly, it's not as enjoyable as coffee.
Right, but it does hold its value. Well, David, just so that we don't sound fatalistic here, where we talk about, oh, well, we have to have hyperinflation. We have to have a complete unwind of the debt. It's all coming to an end. I mean, maybe it is. But you did get together with Lawrence Kotlikoff in August, and that was an interesting interview. And the reason it was an interesting interview is this. Kotlikoff is saying, yes, this is a mess. This system is a mess. The tax code is way too complicated. The printing of the money, the way the Federal Reserve works with the banks, the way the banks speculate without any real risk behind them because of the moral hazard, because it's printed up. But Kotlikoff says, look, we don't have to have this collapse necessarily if we change and simplify. And so, in a way, it was refreshing. Whether it works or not, it's refreshing to talk about an answer to the problem before maybe the complete, utter destruction of the system.
You know, he's taught economics at Boston University for several decades now, and I think the most refreshing part of the conversation with Mr. Kotlikoff was that he brought in a moral component into the work of an economist. And he said it's not the work that we've seen of economists of late, where they'll put together numbers which help a political campaign make an argument. Here's what we're going to do for you. He said, no, it's actually this deep moral. We need to tell them what is happening, not necessarily what they want to hear,
right,
so that they can make adequate preparations and take care of the people that they're responsible for taking care of. So there was that idea that the work that he does has a moral component to it, which I thought was very refreshing. I don't know that I've ever heard that from an economist before. Simplification of the tax code, simplification of health care, simplification of the financial and retirement systems. I mean, this is what he's arguing for as a way of lowering our current costs and, in fact, bringing about an increasing future income. Because what he's looking at, and this, you know, again, going back to Felix Zuloff and seeing sort of an inflationary depression ahead,
right,
that's an inevitable outcome if we don't change the structure of our debt. Because as Kotlikoff says, we've got $211 trillion in terms of a spending gap. The spending gap is what he defines as the net present value of all future incomes and all future expenses. And when you look at those two numbers, there's a difference of $211 trillion. We're spending $211 trillion more than we'll ever bring in. So yes, basically he's underscoring the point that this is a structural issue. We have to change it.
Now, here's my question to him, though, David.
Zuloff is assuming that it's not going to happen. You're not going to reform it, which is why he would say inflationary depression, full steam ahead, we don't have the political will.
Well, and my question to Kotlikoff would be the special interest groups, because it really is the lobbying, the special interest that keeps this system from changing. Talking about simplifying tax and health care and financial and retirement, the problem is that cuts all the guys who are on the take out.
Right.
We can pray for that kind of outcome, but right now it doesn't look promising.
You know, when we talked to Hunter Lewis, September 21st, it was, again, charting back this year, he stated the biggest obstacle was changing the flawed status quo in government.
Well, and just a reminder,
that was not
Hunter Lewis was the man who wrote Where Keynes Went Wrong, speaking of John Maynard Keynes.
Right, and he wasn't being critical of the voting public as much as he was saying that special interest groups are refusing to give up privilege. They've taken on a role in our society and in our political lives that we're not even cognizant of.
Right.
When you go to the voting poll, you assume that you are letting your voice be heard. And he's saying, no. That's once every 2 years. That's once every 4 years. Lobbyists show up at the doorstep of Washington every day, and they spend tens of millions of dollars to make sure that someone's voice is heard every day. So it's special interest groups who are actually speaking, not us. It's the lobby efforts of these special interest groups, which he considers really toxic to the body politic.
Well, David, we really are seeing a polarity right now of the people. I'm not talking about the parties. The Democrats and the Republicans, they're still talking like Democrats and Republicans. But you also have Occupy Wall Street on one hand, and then you've got the Tea Party on the other. And they're complaining about the problem, because there is a problem. But I think you're probably also seeing some seeing the solution as more socialism, and others seeing it be the complete elimination of the government.
Right. Well, there's certainly an application for the rule of law, and if laws are not being enforced, then they need to be enforced. But it's not a question of growing government to accommodate what should have been done, understanding laws as they're already recognized. And that's certainly where I think the Occupy Wall Street folks would say something has to change, and we'd wholeheartedly agree. We just have to enforce the rules that already exist versus giving a free pass. And someone needs to send a memo to the SEC and say, quit destroying your own documents. It doesn't help with the idea of transparency. 18,000 documents on one go, that doesn't do anything in terms of credibility for whether it's the Occupy Wall Street crowd, the Tea Party crowd, or anyone in between who just simply cares about knowing what's happening on Wall Street. Kevin, I think the issue with Keynes and what Hunter Lewis was pointing to is that we are still attempting to spend our way to recovery. This is being disproven as we speak, as the means of solving our fiscal and economic issues, our fiscal and economic problems. And yet, bad ideas die hard. It's not going away. The Fed and the Treasury are still trying to prop things up via government spending. This year, instead of seeing a 1 to 2 or even 3% GDP growth, we've got the government spending between $1 and $1.5 trillion, and that has kept us at the 1 to 2 to 3% growth.
So what happens when you pull that out?
We would be worse than the Great Depression today. We'd be in a 6 to 8% contraction. And that's what Keynes would argue. That's the point. The government has to step in and, quote-unquote, prop up aggregate demand. That's the idea. The problem is we're getting to an end game, and this goes back to that 2013 date which Barry Eichengreen was discussing. And what was he fixated on? He was fixated on the rollover of debt. He was fixated on all of these obligations having to be made right and paid on at a particular point in time, 2013 being a very significant date. We can't spend our way to recovery if it's adding to our total stock of debt without complicating a 2013, you know, sort of comeuppance.
Well, you know, it's sort of gallows humor here, so I don't want to say this is funny, but I'm going to say it's funny that not only are we trying to print our way out of our own problem, but here recently, we've been helping Europe try to print their way out of their problem. And I think of our next guest in October, Frank Biancari. Frank Biancari is the one who sees creative destruction in Europe. He actually does want to see some of this creative destruction occur so that they can have a workable, longer-term solution. Now, whether you agree with him or not, it is more of an optimistic plan than just saying, look, let's just try to keep this thing from dying as long as we possibly can, both with European currency, but also with U.S. dollars.
It was fascinating, Kevin, talking to Frank, because you've got the decidedly European perspective set against the decidedly American perspective with Barry Eichengreen, and they're coming at this from very different philosophical bents,
right,
and yet they're seeing the same thing happen.
Yeah.
Dollar reserve system being replaced by a completely new monetary order in that 2012 to 2014 period. So, you know, we've seen this consistent theme both amongst academics and writers from around the world. I just want to make mention of something, because Frank had called me and invited me to do an interview on his behalf. This is a January 2nd interview. It's been taped, and it's going to be aired January 2nd with Fox News, their Power and Money segment. Again, it was Frank who had asked me to share sort of the views of the team and the ideas that he wrote about in his number 58 report.
That's his Global Economic Anticipation Bulletin, number 58, you're talking about, where he actually discusses this transformation.
Right, and it's a transformation that starts with the banking system in Europe, becomes acute in terms of the U.S. banking system, and then has people scrambling for a whole new set of answers. So, I mean, he went so far in that conversation, Kevin, back in October, to assume that over the next 2 to 3 years, we would see a transnational referendum pass in Europe, taking Europe into a new era of both leadership globally, but consolidated strength as well. For us, Kevin, it's a question of sometimes stepping outside of our own skin and saying, what does someone else see?
Right.
What does someone else view from a different, and granted, biased perspective, his European, ours U.S., but from those different centricities, how do they view the world and the things that are happening? And it's very helpful to try to gain an objective view.
Well, and David, I think you can't have any of this progress without having a sound monetary system. This goes back to everything we've been talking about with Eichengreen or what have you. You know, Ian McAvity has been a friend of your family for 40 years. He also really clearly sees that there's going to be a basket of commodities discipline brought to whatever this new currency solution is, whether it's in Europe, America, or both. You know, just your thoughts on that, Dave. Are we going to see gold backing the currency again before these things can change?
Well, yeah, there's a great interview with Ian. I mean, he's been a gold bug for a long, long time. And it reminded me, actually, our conversation with him reminded me of a conversation that we had with Guilio Galrodi back in 2010, where conversation was, again, currencies. Stability of the U.S. dollar, role on the global scene, will it maintain its role of leadership? And his answer was, no, something has to give. Something has to give, but what will replace it is not the gold standard. And again, this is Galrodi's view, but there has to be some element within the new monetary system which represents a discipline so that the world's central bankers cannot print ad infinitum, right, and destroy a currency system over time.
This is that equal weights and measures I was talking about. We all have to play on equal ground. If I can print money and you can't, it doesn't really work for a long time.
The greatest criticism of the gold standard is that it is a disciplined system which ties the hands of central bankers and does not enable them the flexibility that they quote-unquote need.
That's what the Keynesians say.
Right, but every time, I mean, if you look at the history of money, every time that a central banker has abused the privilege they've been given,
right,
the general public ultimately insists that we go back to something that represents a disciplined system that doesn't favor the rich, that doesn't favor the politically connected, that doesn't favor anyone, that everyone is on an equal playing field. And so that money system ends up being a vital component towards the application of the rule of law as it is applied equitably. equitably across society. Kevin, what you have is, yes, a basket of commodities in Gal Rhodey's view and in Ian McCavity's view, gold playing some component part. It's already been recognized as a currency, not a commodity. We are heading into a global currency crisis. Why? Because, as we said earlier, that transformation from 71 to the present, where we left the Bretton Woods standard, where gold and the dollar were essentially one and the same, if nothing else, by perception.
Right.
We now have just paper.
We call it fiat.
Right. And that can be dollars. That can be yen. That can be British pounds. That can be euros. It's just paper. And frankly, I like the euro better than the dollar because you can't tear it. It's got kind of a plastic name. It's kind of fun. You know, it has durability to it.
Well, you know, David, I'm thinking about this while you're talking, and I'm thinking, you know, the people. We've talked about the people, the Arab Spring. We've talked about Occupy Wall Street, you know, the Tea Party, and these movements that we're seeing over in Europe and in Russia. The people are starting to actually do these things individually. The governments need to just wake up and say, look, our system's not working. I think about your comments with your dad while you were sitting, I hate to do this, but on the beaches of Hawaii, asking if you had the boldness to ask me if I heard the waves in the background when we were doing the interview. It was cold here, snowing in Durango. But
I know,
here's what your dad and you were talking about. Being pro-gold is actually just saying that you're anti-fiat currency. Now, the governments haven't done that yet because there's too much at stake for them, the special interests. But the people themselves, China, the Middle East, Americans here who've been buying gold, Europeans, it's harder to buy gold coins even in Europe right now. So there is a movement right now of people putting themselves on a gold standard. Maybe the world will follow.
And again, Kevin, we're talking about these substructural changes, nothing obvious. We haven't seen dollar flight. We haven't seen, I mean, things that would be very obvious.
Right.
But there's been a change in disposition, and it's a growing anti-dollar disposition, both by our foreign creditors and emerging market leaders. So you look at the vast majority in the G20, and they'd say, we need to create a workaround. A workaround as in, we don't want to have to go through the dollar to succeed. We don't want our success to be predicated on someone who has foreign policy constraints that we may not be interested in. So how do we work around that? They work around it first and foremost by creating a new monetary regime.
Well, David, you know, the people who are buying gold right now, the ones who are doing it as a currency, as safety, as security, they're not watching the daily price move up and down. They're not speculating.
Well, and I think this is the mistake, and McCavity pointed this out. He said the biggest mistake a gold buyer can make is to watch the price every day. Buying it for the long term, its value as a preservation tool, you don't become a day trader now that you own it. Because what is happening is on a, now a substructural basis, but ultimately a structural basis, wherein you need to know that it was worth owning over the next 3 to 5 years, not the next 3 to 5 nanoseconds, minutes, or days. So if that is your perspective, don't bore yourself with the daily fluctuations and even weekly or monthly volatility in the metals market. You pointed something out, Kevin, that I think is very interesting. Going back to our conversation with Mark Faber, we started the year at $1,300. We're finishing the year nearly $300 higher. This will be the 11th year, if we finish the next three trading days positive, of double-digit returns, positive returns in the gold market. This remains the only bull market in town. The question is, when will it have run its course? And we're talking about the things that define the course for gold over the next several years, which is the remaking of the world's monetary system. Geopolitical instability is just a part of the story. Continued financial instability is just a part of the story. Governments not being able to keep their books straight, that's the economic side of the story. Kevin, all of these things weave in, and we see, yes, a meltdown in Europe and in the United States, at least in terms of our debt structures, but ultimately a redefining of the game altogether, with the most basic of parts being redone. Kevin, that means that this period in time is really like one of those defining moments, like we've talked about repeatedly. 1913, 1922, 1944, 1971, we're on the cusp of one of those defining moments from a monetary standpoint, which will determine the trajectory of our economy and our role of leadership in the world. That's important. And coming into 2012, and frankly more 2013 and 2014, this is what we get to anticipate further.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me, David, just looking at this last year, like we said, this is sort of a reminiscence of the last year. And I have to admit, of the years that we've been doing this program, this one is the most confusing. If you're just watching the ups and downs of the market, it's very difficult, but it makes me think that this is probably, of any person's lifetime, the simplest time to invest. Because in reality, if all you had this year was cash and gold, U.S. dollars and gold, which we've been talking about, keeping the powder dry, not trying to predict the next movement of the European Union or what have you, what we find is that gold's gone from 1,300 to near 1,600, and the dollar has rallied. I mean, yes, we've lost a little bit of buying power. Keeping the powder dry for the period of time that's really, really confusing and simplifying your assets allows you to be able to take advantage of opportunity at the time down the road.
Kevin, I mean, we've talked about monetary regime change. We've got political regime change. With the Arab Spring, we've had a dynamic introduced into the political equation that we haven't seen in a long, long time, where, in essence, social media has redefined what that change looks like and the rapidity with which it takes place.
Right.
That may be the summary statement. Substructural changes that we've seen have pointed us towards one thing, ultimately regime change in 2012 and 2013.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.